the panda is modern myth, so I would say this would be...
Or myths in modern time. Or,
yeah, be...
New myths, so here's I'll
new myths for the modern world.
Discussion point. The whole thing of auras and energy and all of this stuff, I don't see it. I don't perceive it. It's not... I trust that it's probably there, but it seems to be old school. It's like, why would I bother with all of that? I'm more interested in new school things.
I don't think it's that old school.
What is new school?
Yeah.
I don't know.
But you'll know as soon as you see it.
It's by
something
extending
like
and manipulating.
Well, no, new school for me is it's kind of based in science, three-dimensional space-time, what I can feel, what I
Carolian
can...
photography.
Huh?
Carolian photography.
Or a photography. It's yeah.
You know, heat signatures. Whatever.
By manipulating your own aura, that allows you to interact with the quantum levels of reality that lets you, at that point, make changes that have bigger effects than you started with.
Whatever. So, our topic here, since we're five past, and...
There is no God but Murphy, and Heisenberg is his prophet.
New myths and myth as used in modern society. Mm-hmm. Are there old myths that are applicable to modern society?
In essence, myth is a story that expresses an underlying truth. It explains it in easily understood images and makes it more accessible. It uses symbols so that listeners can access layers of understanding as they think about the myth over the years as they grow, so that it resonates with new meaning each time we hear it. Which old myths speak to current issues, and do you have myths that might help illustrate how we can best resolve the new problems we are dealing with today? That is the description for this workshop.
Okay. And that is playing, correct?
Oh, it's been playing since the beginning. So let's introduce ourselves.
Oh, boy.
I'm sure they can edit.
I'm sure.
Well, that was the idea.
You're back.
I'm back.
So my name is Linda DeMissi. I practice in the Northern tradition paganism. Mm-hmm. And I've been recovering stories of Norse goddesses.
Hi, I'm Starwolf. I'm a witch, shaman, rune master, weird scientist, and person who is interested in myths and legends because it's interesting how we keep recycling them.
And I'm Coyote Sky Woman. I'm a shaman and a mythologist. It's my main field of study, along with English literature and language, so.
That's us.
Basically.
Okay. Myths.
I'm kind of need a moderator to sort of be poking or asking questions or something to guide.
Okay, I'm the one with the badge that says moderator, so I guess that's
me. You're it. You're elected.
Yep. Yes. Which in itself is kind of the myth where, to use one out of the American Western canon, I'm the guy who rides into town with the badge in his saddlebag from the last town he worked at. Because the town needs taming, so here I am. And it's appropriate, because in High Noon, his last name was Kane, and that's the name on my driver's license. So, should we start with the basic one, the hero's journey, the one that Campbell loves to tell everybody?
Sure. No, there's nothing wrong with the hero's journey.
No.
It certainly appears in basically every kind of story.
Yeah, that's Star Wars from...
Pretty much.
The three that shouldn't be, all the way through the three that should be.
But you can also look at it with Harry Potter, you can look at it with mm-hmm. Labyrinth, you can look at it with Legend, you can look at it with pretty much anything in modern fantasy literature has elements of the hero's journey.
Yes. But is that the only myth we've got?
No.
Now, admittedly, we're not writing as many myths of beings whose parents were gods, except, of course, we did... have started doing the Percy Jackson series.
Exactly.
Where
and the Egyptian one.
I haven't read that yet.
Yeah, the Red Pyramid, same author.
Okay.
The Red Pyramid, it's the first of the Kane Chronicles. It's the trilogy that's about Egyptian gods.
Seeing I'm sort of occasionally dabble in Kemetics, that might be interesting to read.
So we need a good question, a meaty question. Moderator, O great moderator, give us question.
Why do we feel we need to rewrite the myths?
Why do we feel we need to rewrite the myths?
Why can't we just be satisfied with what's in, Bullfinch, or, what's the other one? Gray something.
Excellent question. I can start with that.
Go ahead.
All right, so, before you see, The Prose Edda, a wonderful book written by Snorri Sturluson about 1,000 years ago. And The Poetic Edda, which is another wonderful book written by a number of people, again, about 1,000 years ago, maybe a little bit older. For the most part, they are stories about warrior gods, written by warrior men, so that they can compose more poetry about warrior kings. Now, there are about... If you could get the door here.
It's got nuts on it.
It's the you Vault of the Mysteries.
Door. Yes. How creepy.
Quiet and failed.
If only that had come at a really significant moment.
Yes.
There sort of did. You asked for the door to close. It closed. That was pretty magical.
Did you see somebody actually close it?
No, I didn't.
That's creepy.
Thank you. So, we have these two wonderful books, which are what most people consider Norse mythology. And there's maybe 15 or so gods in there, and 30 goddesses that are listed, at least listed. Now, out of those two books, I've extracted the stories of the goddesses, and they are right here.
Wow,
this one 8.5 by 11 page. And look, the other side is
blank.
That's right, it's blank.
Mm.
So,
I see a problem here.
There is a bit of a problem. So, in order for me to be satisfied with this mythology of the North, which draws me strongly, I have to basically be satisfied with, oh, let's see, I need to pray to the goddess of healing. Oh, what's the lore about her? Oh, yes, it's four words. The third is Aeir. She is best of physicians. Okay, a bit more than four words. That's it. That's all we know about Aeir. She's also listed as a Valkyrie in a list of Valkyries. She is also listed among Menglofs, maidens of healing. That's it. So, to me, this is unacceptable. And while I can go looking through the sagas for little tiny hints, there really isn't that much because it's mostly written by guys. And it's great for the guys.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. But I need more. So what I've done is for the last 2.5 years, I've been devoting 1 month to each of the 12 goddesses known as Frigga's handmaidens. And the first year is kind of getting to know them. And the second year I started getting stories from them, which I'm writing. And I haven't actually brought them. Oh well. But it's about this thick of stories. So I'm writing these because I need them. And the kind of stories they are is where they go through a dark period, which is usually the reverse of what kind of goddess they're going to be. You know, the goddess of oaths is very indecisive. She doesn't know what she wants to do with her life. And that kind of thing. So, to me, this is finding a place for women and goddesses in our faith.
Okay.
Can I address that one as well?
Sure, go ahead.
I think, you know, if we're looking at why rewrite the myths, why bring them out, why not just have them as they are, from an educator's standpoint, they're not as accessible for the students at this day and age. And I think that's why Percy Jackson is so popular, because the students and the kids are out there, they're reading them, they're understanding them, they're liking them, they're having a much more one-on-one relationship with the deities, with the concepts that are out there of the myths. And it's something that they can actually respond to and can relate to a lot better. I think having taught the Odyssey in a 10th grade class, and we taught a very heavy 1950s translation of the Odyssey that was hard for even me to follow, the kids got really nothing out of it. I ended up doing a synopsis of each section just so they could comprehend it. They'd read it, and they're like, we have no idea what's going on. So we'd spend a lot of time putting things up on the board in class and getting people to put what they understood about it, and it came down to two or three of the students who read and read well, and this was in an honors class. They were not making the connection with the text. They just didn't get it. And it wasn't even in poetic form. It was distilled down into prose. So I think that, you know, rewriting the myths and and putting these together into something that's more modern makes it a lot easier for them to connect to it.
And we're not talking here just modernizing them.
No, actually, and creating new myths as well.
Okay. Well, that answers that question. Next question. Why do we seem to keep... In theory, we have passed beyond the need for myths, at least according to certain myths told by members of a certain other scientific community that would just as soon have our myths go away. But we keep retelling them. We keep needing them. It seems almost a physical need to have myths, to have stories. Is it that we feel we need something to aspire to, or something to take our mind off the fact that we're not quite as good as that? What? Why? Please.
For me, the stories are not so much an accurate description of the lives of these deities as much as how they want to be understood by us. So,
okay, that makes sense.
What we get is, here is something that you humans can understand and relate to about what we're trying to express, convey, teach, guide you in. So perhaps, you know, these mistakes that the goddesses make in the stories I get aren't really the mistakes they made, but we really can't relate to perfect people.
Were you supposed to be moderating this thing, Jane?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
So if we had a story, you know, perfect princess.
Looks like you're moderating it, Starwolf.
I am now.
You know, she grows up, she's beautiful, she learns everything, she knows all the right answers, and nothing bad ever happens. What a boring story. Mm. And we have nothing to learn from it.
Mm-hmm. True.
So there needs to be some kind of failing for a story to be meaningful and make sense, and because we have so many problems in our lives, we need role models.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to find role models.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think it reflects a lot of patterns that even today we follow those same patterns. Things mm-hmm. happen in prescribed ways.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to look at that sort of myth cycle and say, oh, this might come next. Maybe I ought to alter what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. If you're smart, you know,
right.
Then you can say, okay, this is going to, I better go not do that. That could have bad consequences.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Understand if there's some pauses. I did not come prepared to moderate. So
okay, the pauses can be edited.
Good. So could it be that we are basically not just a thinking species, but a myth-making species? That as people, it's almost hardwired in that we will create myths, and perhaps once we reach the point of practical space travel, we might even be doing myths about space travelers?
I think it has to be. I think we have to have something that can explain it. Even if you look at something as complex as theoretical physics, you have to have ways for other people to understand it, so you have to simplify it to some extent. You know, Schrodinger's cat is a good example.
I was just thinking about that.
Schrodinger's cat is a very good example of something that, you know, somebody came up with to explain how something works. It's a myth.
Mm-hmm.
It has certainly become misogynized. I don't know.
Yes. Yes.
And you have even stories about the stories, like Schrodinger and Heisenberg taking a drive.
Yeah, there's stories about that that people have written.
Did they ever arrive at their destination?
Well, yes, we don't know.
Well, they get stopped, you see, and the cop asks Heisenberg, "Do you know how fast you were going?" And he goes, "No, but I know exactly where I was." And he says, "Open the trunk." So he opens the trunk and he finds a dead cat. And he goes over to Schrodinger and says, "Do you know you have a dead cat in your trunk?" "No, but I do now."
Well, it's like in Neil Gaiman's American Gods. There's this long diatribe that one of the characters goes through, and she talks about, you know, that somewhere out there is a box that, and there is a cat in it that's both alive and dead, and then pauses. "Well, I suppose after a while it'll be just two kinds of dead." So it's out there and in the culture.
Right.
It's a way to relate.
And
exactly.
Earlier we were joking about Star Wars and Star Trek, but if you think about it, that is almost two competing myth cycles.
Oh, yeah.
You have the mystics of the Star Wars and the hard science because they certainly do a hack job any deity they run into, of Star Trek.
And for all that, Star Trek is a much more optimistic universe.
Yeah. It's true. It's a universe where they actually start to learn to live together as opposed to one that is plunged into eternal civil war.
Because in the Star Wars, there's always this divide of these two sides.
It's the light and darkness war, which is one of the oldest myths.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
This was the new school that I was speaking of before.
Okay.
But another myth is the hitchhiker, the mystic hitchhiker.
The mystic hitchhiker?
Yeah, and then there's the claw.
Well, you're talking about urban legends.
But
you're going into the whole concept of urban legends.
Well, that's weird.
The choking Doberman and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the claw was essentially something clawing at the car, and you drive faster, but then you find the claw marks on the car.
And sometimes I know...
The mystery hitchhiker who, for the ferryman, carry me over to the other side,
mm-hmm.
because there's something that had not been done, and you find the hitchhiker all over the place.
Oh, and the vanishing car, and the mysterious woman, mm-hmm. and all these various things. And that's the whole concept of the urban myth, which we definitely have created more modernly.
Yeah.
I can think of another one in where when people used to disappear, they assumed they were taken under the hill by the fairies.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're abducted by little gray aliens.
Oh, yeah.
The question is it that the people who are doing the abducting have changed unions, or that they've just changed shapes?
Changed clothing.
Yes, has it been fairies all along and still is fairies masquerading as aliens? Or has it been aliens all along? Or we just haven't figured it out and it's neither?
Seems likely.
Yeah. One of the things I'd like to mention in this is that, as you were saying, using old mythology, the meaning changes.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm reading from the Eddas, what I'm reading doesn't mean what I think it means.
Right.
No.
Our understanding is
totally... keeps using that word, but I do not think it means what I think it means.
Right. And our understanding has evolved, but the story hasn't, but so we have to adapt it.
Right.
To our current understanding. Things just don't mean the same things they used to.
Right. So in one of the stories, one of the ladies has short cropped hair.
Mm-hmm.
Which means in the story that I'm writing what it means today.
Right.
Not what it meant then.
Right.
Today, it tends to mean a more masculine and independent woman. Back then, it meant you were a thrall, a slave,
mm-hmm.
and not the same meaning.
Right.
In fact, the description of this same lady in this one page is that she has long, flowing hair.
Oh, is this Sif?
Fulla.
Okay, Fulla. But the Sif legend was that Loki cut Sif's hair off. But Sif was essentially the equivalent of the Sami grass maiden. And Loki, being terrestrial fire, have you ever seen a pasture burned off?
Mm-hmm.
And so the crop the next year would be much richer because so much has been returned to the soil, the parasites gone. So you'd have golden harvest, thus Sif's golden hair.
Hmm. As opposed to merely being a case of bad barbering.
Yeah.
Let's see, other myths that we've been recycling lately. Well, obviously there is the one that's on a lot of people's minds with December 21st of this year approaching, the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. The Mayan calendar.
My opinion of that is this is what happens when you take Mayan cosmology, 19th century millenarian thought, and a lot of internalized self-hate, and you kitbash the three of them together. You come up with it's going to be the end of the world. It's going to be the end of a world.
And if I'm not mistaken, world comes from where ald. Where meaning man, and ald meaning age. So age of man, or epoch.
Mm-hmm.
So we're towing into a different age.
Right, a different age,
right.
Which, you know, might not be such a bad thing.
Well, I know that my husband was listening to NPR, as he often does, which I think is a wonderful thing that one of us does.
He's listening to Limbaugh.
Ah, that's true. Mm-hmm. And he caught a report that someone had done with some ancestors of the Mayans, and they were talking to them about this concept of this calendar and what did it mean to them. And apparently they were totally surprised that anybody thought it was going to be the end of the world. They're like, no, it's just going to go reset to the beginning. We're going to have a change of era, a change of some... But they never conceived it, apparently, as an end to the world.
It's the end of a world, which is for them a cosmological cycle, as opposed to the world, which is a physical object.
Right. So
then
even that.
And there's a precession theory in Mithraism, where you're going from Taurus to Aries, and so you're resetting
the calendar.
Yeah.
Yes.
So should we expect it to be about as cataclysmic or exciting as 1999 to 2000?
Yeah, Y2K, totally.
I'm actually no, there will be no obvious difference.
What I'm hoping is there's going to be enough people looking for some sort of positive energetic shift that they're going to sort of will it into happening.
Right. Mm-hmm. That would be nice.
Yeah.
But you know, if you have a little extra water and food, it's probably not a bad thing. In general.
I'm looking for an end of the world party anyway, so
yeah, I made sure that I took that day off because if I'm going to ride out the end of the world, I want to do it at home.
Yeah.
You know, the goddess of protection and warnings of danger says, be prepared. Dark times are coming. Dark times are always coming.
Especially when you
this
live
is nothing new.
Especially when you live above the Arctic Circle.
Yes, yes, yes. So being prepared in general is a good idea because, you know, there's always some war or some economic depression or something happens on a regular basis.
Or the storm blows over your power lines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The dark times come.
Dark times are coming. They're always coming.
Yeah. I know people who keep seeing, well, we had Irene last year and then we had the nor'easter on Halloween and this year we had... we had Sandy, and then we had a nor'easter, and of course there was an earthquake in Maine, just about the same distance between that and Sandy as it was between the earthquake in Virginia last year and Irene. Coincidence? Probably. There was also a pretty big earthquake on Vancouver Island a couple of days ago, but nobody's been making a big thing about that one.
Not really.
Maybe it is meaningful. The question is, what meaning?
Yeah.
Maybe it means that Mickey Mouse will be the new world leader. Who knows?
I'm with that.
You know, it's interpreting the things. So, you know, it's very easy to interpret the signs after it's happened.
Romney lost the election, sorry.
That would be
he wasn't
goofy.
That cute.
That would be Goofy winning the election.
Right.
Maybe. But let's remain outside of this sphere of...
But I think, you know, even if you look at, okay, we've had 2 years of coincidence, we still don't have enough of a pattern to try and make any kind of judgment call whatsoever. I mean, we can kind of say, okay, what might this mean? And make preparations. Mm-hmm. But other than that, who's to say?
Yeah.
You know, what I would, you know, want to do is, you know, do have about a dozen seers, you know, isolated in rooms, so they go and do their own, you know, control groups to each other, do a scientific, you know, seership experiment, and have them write down their predictions, and seal. You know, and then
how do you isolate seers?
Ah,
being a seer myself, how do you do that?
Well, you just put them in separate rooms. If they can communicate telepathically, that's their problem.
You line everything with
lead.
That's right. But then they can't see the future necessarily. But yes, I mean, instead of all being, I wonder what's going to happen. Well, if we have supposed clairvoyance, let them, you know, make their own predictions, and whoever gets it right gets the candy.
Or if you have a bunch of people that are all saying the same thing, that might give it a little bit more.
Exactly.
Hey, he's got the candy. Good.
Yeah.
You can work at it statistically. Well, 73% of mediums say that this particular event is going to happen. You know.
It's about 50%. Let's give it some go. Yeah.
Exactly.
Sounds like weather forecasting. With 80% chance of rain.
Exactly. You just
and
need
if
a.
If it doesn't rain, they said, well, 20%.
20% chance
need
of sunny.
A bunch of psychics.
Yeah.
I have a
yes.
question.
Sure.
Well, what about like television? Actually, is a vehicle for like new myths and stories and that kind of thing. Like I'm thinking of you know, some popular things like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Firefly, and like some of these kind of modern
the TARDIS.
Yeah.
Oh, Doctor Who.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's a big one too. They're almost like mythologies of their own.
It does certainly.
They're certainly cults of their own.
Yeah, but I would say, considering how long Doctor Who has been running, it's got its own mythology, or at least body of concepts, if you don't want to term it mythology, that it runs by. So it's got enough that you can refer back to and say, okay, this happened here, so this happens here. So likelihood of, and there you go.
That's what, sort of on this topic, Hunger Games, how does that fit in?
Hunger Games definitely has its own mythology, I would say so. It's dystopian fiction. It's something that is a warning because it's set in the United States after a war, and this is what it's broken down into. I would definitely say it's evolved its own mythology. It's very, even though it's dystopic and it's following some older patterns, the whole concept of going in and sending these tributes in to fight for their freedom echoes some older stuff, but
sounds
brings it
like
into
Theseus
much more
of the Minotaur.
Yes. Well, yes, it does. But they're
that?
Not fighting a monster in the middle, they're
Theseus
fighting each
the
other.
Minotaur.
So it's not quite the same thing unless you look at the Minotaur as a symbol of fighting yourself. Mm. So you could.
You could also throw Avatar in there.
You could.
And
well, which one? The cartoon version or the James
movie.
Cameron? The movie. Okay.
And because in the Sami lore, back in 1400 something, Tudis came in, they were superior armed people and were trying to take over, but the Sami were able to defeat them with their Nuada, the shamans, and so you see this in the movie The Pathfinder,
mm-hmm.
but you see echoes of that also in Avatar.
I think there's a lot of echoes of a lot of things in Avatar.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of world mythology that can be poked at there.
Yeah, like the cripple who becomes the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And who's then made whole by effectively their earth goddess.
Well, it's similar to the Fisher King in a lot of ways, yeah.
So I'd like to ask, I don't know if you're...
Just not as big on Arthurian as I am on a lot of other things.
So I'd like to ask, do we have any new mythology that helps us deal with the big problems that we're facing in our personal lives and in our, you know, countries? Mm. Are there solutions in myths, or are we just, you know, flopping around trying to find something?
Hmm. And what pops into my mind immediately is trust the Force.
Trust the Force? Okay.
And that's only half being facetious?
Yeah.
I mean, global warming, wars, possibly economic, you know, depressions. Do we have any mythology that's about what do you do in this case?
Hmm.
Or do we need to have some?
We definitely need it.
Yeah.
So I can't think of anything offhand that...
Well, this is something that came up over the course of the summer for me, and I was doing research on mythology for a grad course that I'd kind of created because they didn't have one in mythology. I said, I want one. So I found a teacher who was willing to suffer me for the summer because she wasn't really heavy in her own mythology background. And when I was looking at I ended up doing a lot of work on tricksters, which I won't get into now because I'm going to talk about it more tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But what I found was that we, as a culture, specifically don't. We haven't really evolved a lot of new mythology because our heroes have become movie stars. So maybe there's a mythology around the movie stars that's evolved, and sports stars and things like that. But then they fail at the end of the day, I guess is the best way to put it, is they're still mortal. And they're not gods. I mean, we treat them like gods and we act about them like gods, but they aren't gods at the end of the day. And they haven't quite made it to that status.
There's been no apotheosis in at least 2,000 years.
No.
Well, I mean, the Greek and Roman gods are certainly in no way perfect. Right?
No, they're not perfect, but they're not mortal. And I think that's one of the biggest problems. I mean, we can say, oh, well, movie stars are still on film, and therefore they're immortal because we still see them. And you can kind of, if you stretch it really far, but I mean, even in my research of trying to figure out is there a modern-day equivalent to the trickster and what has happened to that sort of idea, The closest I've come to has been comedians, and the closest comedian was George Carlin to being the trickster, the epitome of the trickster figure. But other than that, we really haven't been creating...
Bugs Bunny?
Bugs Bunny is close.
Yeah.
Bugs Bunny is close.
What about the Western? The old ogres.
The Western.
Wear the white hat, and you ride into town, and you see this again and again and again and again.
I actually touched on that at the beginning of this.
Yeah, I missed that.
But, yeah, in many ways, a lot of the Westerns do have a certain amount of the old hero tales, at least, if not of gods, certainly of heroes.
So it's readaptation of myth.
Well, look at Zorro.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Lone Ranger, Zorro. Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned before, the Cain in High Noon.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have myth. We don't have myths. We've got hero tales.
We have hero tales. We don't really have new myths. We have adaptations a lot of the way of old myths. You know, comic book heroes, a lot of times, those get dragged into the concept. Superman and Batman and characters like that, and the characters of the Watchmen, that tends to fall into that.
Superman will save the day.
Yes. Mm. He's probably the closest we've got to a god.
Probably.
Yeah.
I don't know. Being a Marvel fan, we do have a few gods.
True. But they're readaptations.
Yeah.
Mickey Mouse, as we mentioned before.
I don't think Mickey Mouse will save the world.
But I do remember one episode of Babylon 5 where they were trying to find Garibaldi, and Delenn had gone into Garibaldi's quarters to try and get a feeling of the man, and there was a picture of Daffy Duck. And Delenn asked Ivanova, is that one of his household gods? And she said, well, he could be considered the god of rage and frustration.
Suffering succotash.
No, that's Sylvester.
That's Sylvester.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Another deity of rage and frustration.
That's right.
Eternally in pursuit of the Tweety Bird.
Little snippet. Everyone recognized who she was talking about. I mean, is that not what we're talking about?
This would be called in Irish storytelling a ran, I believe.
Okay.
Like this familiar. One repeating little thing that keeps being used.
A little theme.
A little theme. Like in the story, it was like, and she was so ugly. You know, with a little facial expression and the gesture that, you know, keep carrying through the story. And yes, these expressions are used in our modern hero tales. And storytelling hasn't changed that much, even though we have our own little storyteller box in our homes, which at will serve us entertainment.
Mm-hmm. This is true.
But times one doesn't recognize a myth until that myth-making period is past. And then you look back into the past and say, oh, what a nice myth.
And I think that maybe is the case of the ancient myths, too, is the fact that maybe they were based on things that had happened and events that happened, and they became mythologized, and that just was something that occurred. So, and it was, you know, turned into something else. You can go into the whole concept of when we have Mithras, and then Mithrin, and then going into Jesus, and then going into all these other things that follow that same pattern, that have become their own myth, but based on something older, but because it's familiar.
Now, the one thing that our TV storyteller box doesn't do is adapt the stories to our needs.
True. No, that's true.
After I'd spent a year collecting stories, I came back to Sagas Month, whereupon I got told, by the way, you're really not supposed to write out the stories long form. That's not how you do it in an oral tradition. What you're supposed to do is write down the bones of the story in verse form, so that you can transmit that, and the other storytellers and bards can memorize that. And then, depending on what's happening, they will spin the tale anew that is completely appropriate to this tragedy of your child dying, or this great joy of a wedding, to make it fit, to make it give meaning to what's happening in our lives.
Right, to make it a personal myth.
To make it a personal myth. And that's the thing, it's like, to be alive, these kinds of stories have to be told to be alive. They have to be told in a way that is not verbatim from, you know, the edition of whoever wrote them down.
Right. There was a beautiful rendition, and I hope to get a copy of it at some point, but I went out to the Study of Myth conference at the end of August out in Santa Barbara. And that in itself was its own mythic tale, just the whole trip and its return, because that was, for me, it was a myth. But there was a gentleman who did the entire story of Gilgamesh, not by rote, but just by telling. And he definitely reacted in his telling to the way the audience was responding. And he tailored it, very much so, to the way it was being told. And it was beautifully done, and he was hysterically funny. But it got the audience involved, and we were able to relate, because he used modern language in such a way, and he's like, oh, well, she was, you know, she was such a bitch, and just, you know, talking about the goddess and the way she had reacted to something. And it made it feel like, okay, we can relate to this story, even with profanity. We can relate to this story because of the way the character was acting and the way they were responding.
We can recognize ourselves in the stories.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, certain stories are eternal, like the death and resurrection one.
Mm-hmm.
So we certainly have that in Star Wars with Anakin Skywalker's fall during the first three and his eventual redemption and resurrection in the third one. But even if he does come back, there's kind of a glowing hologram with the other two.
There's even a little bit of the death and resurrection with Han Solo being frozen and being brought back. It's a little more minor, but
that's almost Inanna's descent into hell to bring back the spirit of Tammuz. We're getting into myths that I'm more familiar with.
That's good.
So, I was intrigued by your idea of not writing down verbatim in the in how that compares to, say, the Torah, which is very much verbatim, passed down exactly, and really this hallowed text. Where does that fit in this structure?
I would think that the Torah is more a list of spells, though, more than anything else, is the way it would be looked at. Because it's a history, but it's also a very specific language that's being used to evoke a very specific way of thought. So I think in that case, you might want to, if it was going to be something like that, have it very, you know, you have to keep it the same way. You have to say it the same way each time.
So it's not a collection of myths.
I think there is some in it, but I think they're trying to preserve it, and it's written down, so when it does become written down, then it kind of locks it into form.
And the same could be said for any myth.
Because these were written down by monks. The Vikings did not, you know, write down their stories. They transmitted them orally, and the only way to really retain a story like that and not lose parts of it is to have verse as a mnemonic. So because it's an oral tradition as opposed to a written tradition, which, you know, the Jewish tradition is very ancient in being a written tradition. Mm-hmm. At least part of it.
Pardon?
At least part
of
it. You know, there's the oral part as well, but, you know, this was entirely oral. So it makes a very big difference. You know, Christian tradition, again, Christian is very much about the written word.
Mm-hmm. But that was the accessibility of Bellum. Mm-hmm. There are references on the runestones to events such as Thor's fishing trip on at least one runestone. But there are, again, references to other myths which are now lost, like on the Rigstone, which refers in very skeletal words of past myths which are gone. They have not been preserved. But the monks were also had their own agenda.
Mm-hmm. Right, so the myths that did not serve their goals were not written down because they didn't need to. And, you know, I'm sure the stories of powerful women doing incredible things was not helpful to the Christian monks.
No.
Probably not, no.
And so they just conveniently did not write them down.
Well, it's the same thing with the Bible. Let's take out anything that's going to have a positive mention of this. Oh, we'll decide which ones are going to be representational. Nobody else gets to know. Oh, if you disagree with us, get out of here.
Yeah, you're a heretic.
Yeah.
Yeah, these texts weren't any good anyway.
Yeah, we didn't need them.
You don't need the Book of Enoch. You don't need the 6th, 7th, and 8th books of Moses.
Yeah, they're redundant. We'll get rid of them.
But some stuff is coming up from the archaeological record now that's blowing holes in it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Example,
you have the Nag Hammadi Library.
About Jesus' wife.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah. Nice.
Oh, yes.
Jesus' wife.
Because in order to be named rabbi, you had to be married.
That's. I'm not sure if they fully got the translation of that yet.
Oh, they're pretty good on it.
They're pretty good on it, yeah. Because that's been the argument for quite some time.
There's some people trying to poo-poo that Jesus might have had a wife,
mm-hmm.
but it's to their agenda that Jesus not have a wife.
Right.
Whereas if in period that Jesus did actually have a wife, and in order to be a rabbi, he had to have a wife.
Right.
And he could have also had children.
Yes. And here's where we see the Da Vinci Code, why it would stir up a lot of feathers.
Mm.
And now this new piece of papyrus.
The concept of that there is a bloodline of...
The Sang Real.
Or specifically a bloodline of demigods walking around.
Well, even before the parchment, there are books in the Nag Hammadi Library and there are books in the Dead Sea Scrolls that reference... Mary Magdalene and reference, you know, women being part of the group. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of them is saying that at one point, I can't remember which one of the Gospels it was that came from, I think it was from the Nag Hammadi Library, though, and that Jesus was more tender towards Mary than anyone else and mm-hmm. kissed her on her mouth, and Peter complained because why is the Lord giving her more preference than the rest of us, and it was explained that she was the first among what have you. And it was an interesting concept because that does indicate that this is what's been taken out and what's been hidden because they had their agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with the Eddas.
Everyone has an axe to grind.
Yeah.
Which is why Inanna's descent changed from her going down to challenge her sister to her going down to rescue her lover.
Hmm.
Oh boy, I've really brought the conversation to an end.
Just a brief pause. Yeah. I think it's reflective.
Yeah.
It's a pregnant pause.
Oh, goody. So what else can we kitbash around here? Okay. Let's see.
But Völuspá in the Poetic Edda incorporates Christian mythology, where they're trying to retread Baldur as Kvitha Kris, the white Christ, who's all in the way. You have Ragnarök, which essentially is Edaic, but I don't think you have much reference at all to it previously in any of the rock carvings, etc. So here is the superimposition of myth upon myth.
So the concept that Ragnarök may have been brought in by Christian monks who were looking for an Armageddon analogy.
So that they could have the White One and Baldur as the and as an analog of Jesus.
And from
it's fairly clear.
And from Evan Deere, I hear the echo of somebody smacking his head repeatedly against a wall, yelling, "No, no, no!"
Evan Deere?
Hela's Fortress?
Oh. So, here's a question. What's the difference between... Because you were referring to the difference of heroes and gods and demigods. So, really, what does it matter if we only have stories about heroes and not stories of gods and demigods?
Because there's no transcendence in hero tales. In the tales of gods, there's the potential for transcendence, for
you
becoming...
might want to speak louder.
Sorry,
for the
there's the potential for transcendence, for becoming more than mortal, more than man, more than animate clay. Heroes, for all their power, remain mortal. Gods and demigods are something more than mortal, more than just merely human. And
why does it matter?
Because it's something to aspire to beyond humanity.
Hmm. It's something to try to reach. It's something to try to say this is the ultimate goal. Well, if Hercules could do this, so could we.
Yeah.
But in a monotheistic world, they tend to frown on...
And people transcending reality, yes.
And transcending.
But we're not really in a monotheistic world. Not all of the cultures that we have around us are monotheistic.
No, but there is a resistance to a human becoming more than human.
Well, look at the Hindu. You're looking at the Bodhisattvas. You have something where you have transcended further.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, the bulk of the human race lives in a non-monotheistic reality.
Mm-hmm.
Where the potential to... climb, whether you want to trick, fight, or merely work your way up the ladder to some level of transcendence exists. And indeed, even in Christianity, when one becomes like Christ, that exists. Though they tend to frown on it, and they, if you really get good, once you die, they slap the term saint on you and kind of lock you into that position. But even in... even in the Book of Mormon, they mention the potential of evolving beyond simple matter. One of the few things I agree with in the damn thing. It's almost like there is almost a portion of the human brain that is hardwired to hunger for transcendence, to hunger to push beyond the boundaries that we exist within now. To boldly go where no man has gone before.
There you go.
Mm. Or actually several of them have. They just haven't bothered to send notes back. Or better yet, a how-to-do-it manual.
Well, what good would a how-to-do-it manual be? You have to figure it out yourself. Mm.
But I think that's one of the things with stories is that they are kind of a how-to manual.
They're hints. Neil Gaiman also wrote a little book. It's adorable. A little tiny book called Instructions. Came out 2 years ago, and it basically is a how to go into the realm of fairies and come back out again.
Really?
And it's great. It's a little children's novel. It's about Yeso by Yeso. And I actually got it because I want to teach it for one of the grad classes that I'm going to be doing a lesson in. So I got the book, and I've got there's a video on YouTube. You can look at this, and it gives the whole thing narrated by Gaiman, and you're watching it. But it talks about, you know, go through the gate you never saw before, go up to the green door, there's a red imp hanging from the knocker, don't touch it, it'll bite. Go through the house, don't eat anything, don't touch anything. You know, but if somebody hungers, feed them. If somebody hurts, heal them. You know, if you can do anything for anyone, do it if it's within your power. You know, and you can turn back and I'll think no more of you, but if you go on. And it goes through the whole thing about what to do, what not to do, and how to make the return voyage again. It's wonderful.
Anybody can get the ferry. It's coming back in one piece.
It's coming back in one piece.
And not ending up Tom of Bedlam.
Yes.
Or winding up in a time period that you recognize.
Well, there's that, too. Yeah. You want to come back to the same place.
Sorry.
Not ending up in a Tom of Bedlam. It's a song basically about somebody who basically challenged the Queen of Fairy and came out of it. He won, but he lost because he ended up insane.
It's the old story of the bard. You go up the mountain, you either come down a bard or you come down totally mad.
Sometimes
or you might
both.
Not come down at all.
Or you might come down both.
Yeah. Both.
Or cursed with, or blessed with, you know, true
telling
speech.
Telling the truth. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's right. Telling the truth.
All the time.
That's what no matter what.
Telling the truth is what gets Loki in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he could lie like a rug.
There's not really a lot of... You look at the stories and find references to Loki lying. There's really not a lot.
Particularly if Thor was around.
No, but even so. I think there's one place where Loki lies in the whole Eddas, but that's it. Even though he's called such many times.
He didn't care about when he was in Aegir Ron's hall. And he was calling everybody, Gefion, you're...
Yeah, but nobody actually denies the accusations. They try to distract him, but nobody ever denies any of the accusations. You would think that if, you know, somebody says, you stole my cake, if you didn't, you would say, no, I didn't steal your cake, instead of going, but... You should insult this person, says another one, because they're really nice. Oh, well, look at you. You know, you went and, you know, you broke this other guy's kite. And then no one says that he didn't break the kite. Somebody else gets up and says, oh, but this person is really nice because they made food for us. That doesn't sound like, you know, saying they lied.
Hmm. I'll look up that one.
Yeah. Gotta find some lies from Loki.
I wouldn't buy a used car from him, but lying, not so much.
Not so much. He's really, as far as I understand, a god of
uncomfortable truths. What he was going to say. Mm-hmm.
A god of uncomfortable truths. Yeah. My perception, anyway.
And given that the trickster is your neck of the woods, a trickster god.
Very much so.
Totally.
Very much so.
and trickster gods, whether it's Loki, Coyote, or Hermes, always seem to get the short end of the stick in the myth cycles.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's always some sun god up there with a tight rear end.
I disagree, actually, come to think of it. I mean, not always. The Monkey King is actually
true.
A really, really good example of one of the tricksters who doesn't get the short end of the stick. He does temporarily.
Indeed. I was watching Forbidden Kingdom before
yes.
I came down
and
here.
They're coming out with a new movie of the Monkey King next
oh,
year, which I think is great to finish
That'll
up the story.
That'll be a third one in my collection.
There you go. But he does, but then eventually he goes on and achieves the wisdom of Buddha. So he doesn't always lose out completely.
Yeah.
Just temporarily.
Buddhism mentioned here.
Well, if we could have gotten a Buddhist to sit in on this panel, we would have.
If we had Buddhist mythology, we'd be talking about myths about liberation.
Yeah.
How to achieve liberation from this world.
Oops.
So the Monkey King, what tradition is that?
Chinese. The Monkey King is Buddhist, Chinese. Hanuman is the other side of the coin. In the Hindu, I believe. And the Monkey King comes from the Chinese. He is born, I don't know the story as
born
well
of,
as I would like to.
Born of stone upon
born
the
of
mountain
stone.
Of fruit and flowers.
Yep.
I only know this because they were talking about it about 2 hours ago.
Yeah, okay, so you're, yeah, I read it like about three
yeah.
or 4 months ago when I was doing some research on
his,
it.
His full title is Great Sage Monkey Equal Unto Heaven.
And eventually he manages to tick off just about everybody, and they get him sealed up inside
a mountain,
and eventually he does get free, and he does break free. But there's a quest involved to do it, and eventually he achieves enlightenment.
Along with his friends Friar Sam and Pigsy. And we are just about over.
Yep.
We have
yep.
about 5 more minutes, so maybe we should start wrapping up. So it does seem that while we may not have written any modern myths, we are recycling the old ones.
Which may have been recycled old ones.
More than likely.
And continuing to be adapted into
mm-hmm.
modern time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a continual process that I think people do. They take the old stories and make them fresh again.
Yeah, and I think, honestly, the old mythologies were fairly thorough in coming up with just about everything you could come across. I mean, we do have the situation nowadays where we have to deal with science and we have to deal with modern technology. But I think, you know, that's something that is being dealt with I think you could say that maybe social media has become somewhat of its own myth,
mm-hmm.
the way it's being run. But it's something that isn't solidified yet. Mm-hmm. I think it's still congealing.
A movie that just came out recently, Cloud Atlas, seems like a fairly modern type of mythology and tale-telling,
mm-hmm.
where the various layers of time are kind of become a little confused because there's this thread going through. Anyway, it's something to look into.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Hmm. Worth checking out.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that about wraps it up unless somebody
has
a final statement or a final question.